Code monkey, get up, get coffee. Code monkey, go to job. Code monkey, have boring meeting with boring manager Rob. Code monkey, like you. Code monkey, like you.
Hello and welcome to the Building with Rust podcast, where we chat with folks who work with and within the Rust community. I'm your host, Sean Chen. And today it's my pleasure to be joined by Ernest Kisiedu, who is a co-founder of the DevX initiative, as well as Rust London community lead. Did I get that right?
Yes, you did. Well done, Sean. Yes. Thank you very much for having me here. I am really excited and nervous to be here, but thank you again.
Yeah. How are you doing, Ernest?
I'm okay. I'm hanging in there by a thread, you know. There's been lots going on, lots of exciting things, lots of really positive things, spinning lots of different plates. But yeah, I'm really grateful for everything that I've got going on and doing well overall.
Cool. So I guess I wanted to, usually I start off, you know, talking about how you got into Rust. So that's as good a place as any to start, I suppose. So kind of, yeah, how did you get involved in Rust specifically?
So, yeah, it's a bit of a winding story. So I always start by kind of prefixing my journey into the programming language. Game development is my heart and soul. It still is. It's everything that I've wanted to do since I was like 14 years old, 12 years old. And that meant C++ or learning C++. That's what you're told. That's what you're taught. That's what you are expected to do when it comes to game dev mostly. And, you know, I always have this saying that C++ is like a priesthood, right? In that it takes everything from you and it demands everything from you, you know. You can't have a life, you can't have a family, no kids. You must devote yourself to C++ solely and totally for the rest of your life. Programming and horrible templates and memory seg faults forever. That's what you're committed to, you know? So that's what kind of got me started, interested in software development in general. And being from London, being born and raised in London, I'm really privileged that there is still such a huge developer hub here in the city. And that led me to have the opportunity to explore a lot of different software developer communities that sprung up from the city. A lot of the time you would find that there are many different places that you can just go and hang out and speak with like-minded people and meet up with like-minded people who are interested in all kinds of weird, exotic programming languages, especially in the center of London, in the city of London. With London being such a financial hub in Europe, it attracts developer talent from all over the world, especially from all over Europe. And you tend to find that after work, everybody takes off their ties and actually gets into the stuff they're really interested in. After working on like horrible legacy Java enterprise stuff and, you know, Python or whatever, you know, after work, everybody goes and hangs out at a bar or at a meetup where they get to actually talk about and get into the stuff they're really into. So I was really privileged to be in the mix amongst that. And this was all, you know, through 2013, 2014, just literally spending a lot of time at different developer meetups and wanting to connect with people, wanting to be part of a community. It was really important to open myself up to a lot of the new ideas and things that were happening. And, you know, one of the hubs that were quite prominent in London at the time was a place called CodeNode. And you would literally go there and hang out and there would be a meeting for Scala, there would be a meeting for Haskell, there would be a meeting for Unity game development, and you would literally just hang around. They had a bar, they had a pool table, the whole thing, and just meet up with different people there and have all of these talks. And one time I went down there and I just stumbled in on this incredible meetup of people. This was around, I think I always get fuzzy with the dates because, you know, time is such a blur right now. But I stumbled upon this meetup group, the Rust London user group. This was maybe around, I think maybe mid 2016, or maybe beginning of 2016, end of 2015. And, you know, they were talking about this new systems programming language that had all of these amazing properties and had all of these amazing features around memory management. And it had a compiler that basically didn't hate you. So it was great to kind of like just explore that, you know, and sit in the room. And I had an amazing kind of epiphany moment when I kept coming back to these meetups and seeing how friendly the community and open the community is. It made me really feel like, wow, you know what? I don't have to hate my life and programming all the time, because there is another way. There are things really developing with lots of new languages that were coming out at the time, but especially with Rust. And I do also want to put out a disclaimer. I do still love C++. It may feel like I'm ragging on C++ a bit, but no, I do love it as a language still and everything. It's just such an ocean of a thing that you can get lost in it so easily. So that was pretty much how I discovered Rust initially. My whole agenda with going to the meetups and being a part of the community was, you know, to be the dumbest person in the room. And I can tell you, I achieved that very easily. I achieved that. I still feel like that today. And, you know, at the time you were in the room with chief scientist this and CTO that, and people, you know, quants who were looking at moving code bases over from C++ into this new language. And it was, you know, such an inspiring environment to be in, but also quite intimidating, you know, because here's me just sat in the corner. I'm just trying to see if I can make some cool games out of this. And it's just kind of like, wow, you know, it was really, really an interesting time to discover Rust, especially getting into like just after 1.0 into 2016, 2017. Where a lot of things were redeveloping and the momentum was really building, and it felt like, wow, you really want to be in the mix with this new thing. You know, you then hear about the Stack Overflow stuff, and, you know, then you start actually getting hands-on with it. You realize like, oh, this actually makes sense, you know. So Rust has a big emphasis on community, and that's how I found my way into the language, is through the community itself.
Yeah, so you mentioned game development, pretty common avenue into programming for a lot of folks, but like especially around the timeline you mentioned, like 1.0, 2015, 2016, like at that point game development I'm sure was just like a rather far off like potential. Right, yeah. Like it was not.
Yeah, Bevy didn't really exist then. I don't think it did. There was people who were tinkering and doing a lot of toy projects, showing that you can do this with it. There was the game dev working group at the time, but not where we are now. You know, things have come so far. You see Bevy and Godot, you know, two really interesting engines, and of course all of the stuff that Embark are doing. I mean, you know, to be fair, Embark were doing some incredible stuff even then with Rust, but you know, seeing now that there are more green shoots coming up in terms of Rust game development. Everything that Forrest and the rest of the folks over in the game dev corner of Rust are doing. I can't say enough about how great that stuff is. So salute all those folks over there. It just felt positive. It felt like this is something that could really make an impact if it continued with the momentum that it has done.
So like, regardless, you know, like, even though it wasn't concrete at that point, it still like grabbed you and pulled you in.
Yes. Cause it was the potential, you know, it was seeing how vibrant the community is. I always want to, you know, cause it's still that way. Even though it was then, you know, it was seeing the forward momentum that just felt like it was going places. And looking at the pace of features that were being added, you felt like, well, look, something's going to come out of this, you know, and you know, what more than game development, you know, would you be able to see something really impactful come out of all of the progress that was being made? So, yeah, I mean, it just felt really positive then. It feels even more positive now, and the momentum just kind of carries you forward. And it kind of almost sweeps you away into it.
Yeah. And, you know, I wholeheartedly agree and relate to what you said about the community aspect of Rust being, I think, really the linchpin that, you know, that I love about the ecosystem. I mean, don't get me wrong, like, Rust is absolutely a super cool language with lots of cool features, and it itself is a joy to use. But, you know, every time I think back to, if it was just the language and we didn't have this amazing community of super friendly folks around it, like, how much would I like it? You know, probably significantly less. It'd probably still be my favorite language to use, but like, I don't think I would, you know, have started a podcast about it. I wouldn't, you know, enjoy talking to so many of the folks that I've talked to within it as much as I do.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's the accessibility of people who you would look up to that makes it even more impactful on someone coming in who's learning programming, even not just learning Rust, but learning programming. Is that it's the accessibility of people, you know, being able to be around people who are actually building out the language, and they're really cool, like answering questions on Twitter and being available to mentor. It's something really special and something that I haven't seen in any other sort of software development community. And again, I always say that, you know, the community is the crown jewel of the Rust ecosystem. And it's something that is really what sets it apart, even beyond the great features that the language has itself.
Yeah, absolutely. So you mentioned you're, you know, the lead of the Rust London user group. Like, kind of how did that come about? You know, you mentioned the origin of how you started there, and how did you get to the point you're at now?
Yeah. So, yeah, I mentioned that I was like sitting in the corner of the room at most of the meetups, didn't understand a thing. And it was at the time, it was the community was being led by Mark Santana, and also Aiden Hobson Sayers, and a group of other individuals, Aminu Diantras. All of these people are now like highest echelons of Rust now. And it's incredible to see the journey that they've all been on. Rust London, it kind of, the lore differs from who you may speak to. Some say that we're the first Rust community chapter. Some say we're second after Oregon, because Mozilla had an office in London, but of course, Mozilla coming from Oregon, you know, Oregon claim themselves as the first Rust community chapter, but then we're also staking a claim to that as well. And I just kept coming to the meetups, and I felt it was important to help out and contribute and empower myself. In all honesty, it was about you know, not wanting to necessarily just be passive and take in the talks and eat the pizza and the beer.
Of course, the pizza.
That was at the meetups. So I decided to put my hand up to help organize some of the meetups. At the time, things were being hosted, still hosted at CodeNode, and there were two meetups. There were two London meetups. You had the Rust London Talks, which was a showcase, very much like any other conventional meetup that you would go to. Someone talks about a project they're building or something they're doing or a concept that they want to teach to the audience. And there was also the Hack and Learn, which was more of a communal hangout where we would get together and have pizza and have drinks, and people who were more experienced, people who were using this weird thing called Nightly, would sit on one side of the room, and people who were just going from like zero to Hello World and getting Cargo installed would sit in another side of the room. But then there would still be cross-pollination as well. And that was another community event that was put on. And I put my hand up to help, even though I had no clue about how to program in Rust, but I was just throwing myself in there to, again, help the community, but also help empower myself. And it came to a point where Mark had to leave London to take a role outside of London. He's always had a dream of moving out of London and living in the countryside, in the beautiful countryside of the UK. And, you know, he really, again, I keep using the word empower because that is the tagline of Rust, but it's also my lived experience of the language as well. So Mark was incredible in just helping me build my own confidence. And he's my Yoda, right? Like he really was like very encouraging of me to not feel like an imposter, to not feel like, hey, you don't belong here. Like he was very ready to just shove me in my back and say, okay, well, you get involved, you jump on board and take things on. So there was a point where there were a few other people involved in getting and running and facilitating the community events. But as with like life, things get really difficult. So there was a bit of a hiatus with community, the Rust community. And we had grown to be the largest Rust community chapter globally. At the time, we had around 1,500 members as per meetup.com, as per what meetup.com says. And we were holding events every month, and it really got a lot for Mark and the rest of the team. So Mark leaving, there was a bit of a hiatus, and I didn't want this to die. You know, I didn't want the community to just peter out and just kind of dissipate, because, you know, developers will find something else to get into. There's always something else to kind of occupy your time. So, you know, coming back to saying being the dumbest person in the room, that still is my intention. And I kind of felt to myself, well, if I can't be the dumbest person in the room, I will curate the room. You know, I don't want the room to disappear. I want to continue to be learning from my peers. I still want to be immersed around all of these incredible minds and all the different diverse people who are, you know, really trying to push something new forward. So I decided to take on leadership of and basically organizing the Rust London Talks and the Hack and Learns. This happened March 2019. This also came from me being canned from a dev role as well, which was quite painful. And it was a real blow to my confidence at the time as well. You know, everybody goes through that process when you work for like a startup and the whole dev team just gets canned. But that impacted me quite a bit. And it was about me empowering myself again, to be like, well, look, I still want to be a part of this community. I want to get back to my own learning agenda and really take on this language with both hands. And no better way to do it than being involved in making sure the community thrives and I've got peers around me to learn from. So there is a self-serving element in it, you know. I want to be around more devs that are writing Rust that we can all get along with and kind of vibe with, you know. So I continue to take on the organizing of the London Talks and the Hack and Learn. And through April, May of 2019, we were being hosted by Cloudflare, because that was a seminal year for Rust. If you remember at that time, you know, async had just gotten into the standard library. There was a lot of questions around when async await. There were lots of things happening with the web frameworks that were actually becoming more and more used and taken more seriously. There were more people using Rust in production. So the community went through another boost of growth there. And I'm really, really grateful to have been able to help facilitate that and to help continue that by making sure that there was a place where people could come and convalesce and chat and, you know, talk to each other and continue to build. So we were being hosted by Cloudflare at the time, who were heavily into Rust. You know, they still are, I think, using Rust for lots of different components, their backend services. And it was that point where it pretty much turned into like a full-time gig, you know, having to find speakers and organize the venue and advertise and put it all out. It was like a real thing, you know. So it gave me a focus, it gave me it's still giving me a drive to move forward with the language. And yeah, that's how I kind of ended up being the lead of the Rust London user group. It was pretty much because nobody else had time to do all of the stuff that goes in with like a community and making sure things are vibrant and thriving and done. So I hope that answers your question.
No, absolutely. And is it fair to say then, like, kind of going from that led into co-founding DevX? It's like, what, yes. Is there a relationship there?
Yeah. So DevX was interesting how that came about. So in parallel with me taking leadership of the Rust community, I mean, at that time, there was a lot of buzz around blockchain and Rust's use in the blockchain space. I mean, whatever way you feel about that, it was the fact of how, you know, much Rust was being done by that space and still is. I, at the time, had a great relationship with Benny Isenbert. And we actually met through a privacy forum. So it was a forum that was, you know, talking about things going on with Julian Assange and Edward Snowden and privacy as a human right and things like that. And wanting to see how, like, those things could be evolved and protected in the future. And we actually also began discussing the state of open source at the time as well. So it was a lot of different things that factored into the creation of DevX that we were wrestling with at the time. Benny he has a PhD in philosophy from Johns Hopkins. So when you start a conversation with Benny, you got to strap yourself in because you're in it for the long haul, right? So we would have these long winding conversations about the nature of reciprocity in an open source community, the nature of how the dynamics work when it comes down to money in an open source community. Another person who I'd had lots of conversations in about this particular topic, who gave me actually a lot of insights, was Florian Gilcher from Ferris Systems. We would talk about his past experiences with almost having to fundraise and find and money to try and facilitate a lot of what was needed in an open source community, and the lack of mechanisms and protocols for how money is done in open source. And that's still a problem. You know, that's still a massive problem, even more so today. LogForge last year, so many other things that we can cite where maintainership and the dynamic of how things work with maintainers and contributors in an open source ecosystem. And I want to be as succinct as possible. A free open source community is what led us to really try and make an impact through the DevEx initiative. So through our conversations and debates and discourses around that, we wanted to try and create something that would bridge the gap between commercial entities who benefit from free and open source software, communities, and the individuals who maintain it, and the people who are on the ground actually doing the work, who are, you know, in many cases, volunteers, students, people who are doing this for the love of the community, for the love of the technology, to empower themselves by learning. But, you know, are basically contributing to like trillion-dollar companies and things like that. We felt that there has to be a way where there can be a connection. Like we want to bridge the divide between the disconnect of that, you know. And that's where the DevEx initiative came out as an idea. It did masquerade itself a bit as a DevRel initiative when we first started it out, because that was a means for us to be able to bootstrap our funding, essentially. And also it was a way for us to have the scope to really try out the idea of this, what we wanted to achieve. So we wanted to try it with a team that would be open to some of the ideas that we have. And that worked kind of well, but again, it's a very difficult thing to tackle, you know, money and open source and commercial mandates and agendas. Very, very hard to reconcile all of those things. So, the DevEx initiative came about through my work that I've already been doing in the community through the Rust London user group, and translating that into trying to help empower open source, free open source communities do money better and almost have a hustle ethic that will allow sustenance to come into the community and for things to be sustainable. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, a bit. I did read a very recent article that was put out about DevEx basically going independent. So yes. from my understanding, you know, the commercial entity that the initiative was partnered with was Concordium. And now it's, I guess it sounds like that relationship is no longer there and they're not presumably providing funding, right? And now the initiative is free to kind of chart your own course and plot your own destiny and all that good stuff. But of course the question then is, you know, where's the funding going to come from now?
Yeah, that is the question, right? And that is what keeps me up at night right now. That's what I'm working on with various individuals, trying to understand how to make that work. So we are open to people who want to know more about the DevEx initiative and have a not just an understanding of free open source, but also have a desire to help make things better in this space. One company that I always cite and really give a big shout out and kudos to is Embark Studios, because it was their approach to sponsorship through GitHub sponsors that really inspired the DevEx initiative. Seeing what Johan and the Embark team do with their sponsorship approach is what actually led us to focus on sponsoring through GitHub sponsors and taking the approach that we have taken. So the DevEx initiative isn't just a sponsorship program, and it's not just about money and maintainers and open source. What I have as a vision with Benny is a on-ramp for individuals who want to contribute to free open source projects and not get screwed over, basically. It's about enabling people to feel quote-unquote worthy enough to be contributors to an open source project, to feel empowered and to feel able to commit to maintaining their contributions in an open source project without having to like eat ramen noodles for like every day because there's like they're broke all the time, and or they just get hired by a company and they're now on that company's mandate. And I want to also be very specific and say that it's great that companies hire maintainers of open source projects. I think it's important that they do that. I think it's great that there are a huge number of roles in Rust and growing. I mean, I was just talking to someone this afternoon about, you know, a lot of the stuff that's being done in AWS, for example. I think it's also important that maintainers can have the choice to be independent of being hired by a company and to still feel like they are supported by commercial entities who will inevitably make money from their maintenance and their work. And that's where we want to try and give people the opportunity to do that, because it's the right thing to do. And that's where me saying that open to companies who want to do the right thing is because you get it. You get that, like, hey, there's a 17-year-old high school kid who's maintaining the docs for this crate that everybody uses. Wouldn't it be nice if they were sponsored? Just so that, you know, appreciation, but also, again, that word again, empowering them to continue to do that for as long as they feel like they want to. Because, you know, contributing to an open source project is a choice. Nobody has to do it. And we see that happen all the time when crates become deprecated, crates aren't maintained, because people can't. People can't keep doing that off their own time, off their own back, off their own effort. So if there's a way to incentivize that through sponsorship, that is something that we want to be the bridge that people meet on and are able to do. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And I kind of really, I love that, you know, portrait that you kind of paint there with what the vision is. And I really appreciate it. Apologies if this is maybe comes across as a little bit of a hardball question, but like the thing I kept thinking of was, okay, there's DevEx, and then the immediate kind of other entity in the space that I think of with regards to this is the Rust Foundation.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, okay, so you're ready for this. So how do you kind of think about, you know, the union of what DevEx and the Rust Foundation do, as well as the intersection? Like,
yes, definitely intersection and diversity, variety. We don't want to be the only shop in town doing this. We actually want more DevEx initiatives out there. We want more people, because we were inspired by people who were already doing this. I cite Embark and Occam and Discord and Fly.io. So having diverse, decentralized arrays of people who want to all bring something to the table is something that we are very, very cognizant of, and that's our focus. So the Rust Foundation, we intersect, and we hope one day to partner. There isn't an us and them. I believe there's just an us, as in we're all trying to achieve the same thing, which is a vibrant, again, empowered Rust ecosystem. And we are taking a specific approach because of how nimble and where we focus our priority on. The Rust Foundation has many, many more considerations and is an organization that has to factor in so many more things than we do. So, you know, I really sympathize with a lot of what they have to deal with and work through. But we're not here to usurp anyone. We're here to work with all parties who want to be the tide that we all rise off of, because the DevEx Initiative can't do something like this on its own. And I would never in a trillion years be arrogant enough to say that, like, we're solving this, you know, in ourselves and what we're trying to do. That is ridiculous. That's absolutely ridiculous. You know, we need more people involved in this, whether they work with the DevEx Initiative, or they work with Embark, or they work and donate to the Rust Foundation. It's all about the bigger end goal. It's all about all of us being the tide that all the ships rise off of. So nothing but love for the Rust Foundation. And again, wherever there are ways to collaborate and cooperate, absolutely. That's literally, you know, my whole focus is reaching out to more collaborators and more people to cooperate with to try and really make an impact on this.
Yeah, I think that was very well said. Yeah. I wanted to maybe shift gears a little bit. So, you know, you've been talking a lot about all the kind of collaboration type work you've been doing, reaching out to folks as far as, you know, figuring out new avenues for funding or for ways that other folks can help. And, you know, it does sound like a lot of work. Do you still get any like programming done, you know, for your own sake now on a day-to-day basis?
I mean, I try. Yeah, it is a lot, as well as also having, you know, other work commitments as well. It is a lot. I mean, I've been building some ASCII terminal games, porting over some C++ ASCII terminal games. Like, that's just my own little side pet project that I've been struggling with for like 18 months. It's just crazy because, you know, there's not a lot of crates for working with the terminal that allow you to do what you want to do when it comes to like gaming, keyboard input. You got to triage a lot of things, but it is a lot of fun still. I'm still learning Rust. I'm still growing in the language. I'm still terrified of lifetimes, and I still don't know what lifetimes are. But it is something that I wish I could always do more of. But having so many plates spinning does keep me busy. And, you know, I get exposed to many different corners of the Rust ecosystem. One of the things about the DevEx initiative, again, is that it's not just a sponsorship program. We have many different facets. One of the components of the DevEx initiative is the Rust Cryptography Interest Group, which we co-founded with Tony Arcieri and Rich Saltz and Diego Arania. So Tony, many people may know Tony as @Bascul on Twitter. Written a lot of the crates that people use. They maintain a lot of crates under rustcrypto.org. And one of the things that we wanted to do with the interest group is to create a place where people can come together without a specific agenda and actually try and plug in some of the holes in what is one of the most important parts of the Rust ecosystem, which is cryptography. You know, when you scratch beneath the surface in a lot of areas, you'll find out that, hey, you know, a lot of the crates that people use are maintained by like two people. And if those two people go, like, it's over. It really is over. So we found that with Rust cryptography, there were a lot of really important areas that were kind of burdened on a particular project or a particular person or a particular set of maintainers. So we wanted to create the Rust Cryptography Interest Group to bring people together as like the Calvary to help out. We have these sync up calls monthly. We haven't done them in a while, but we will be getting back to them, where everybody can get together and we can diagnose what is going on with the Rust cryptography ecosystem, what needs to be done, what holes need to be plugged, and how can we make the whole ecosystem better. Then there's also the Rust formal verification interest group, which is kind of sister organization to Rust cryptography, and that's headed up by Xavier Dennis and Professor Bas Spitters. We support them. They're their own entity. They're not necessarily under the DevEx umbrella, but we support them through the DevEx initiative. And we also have plans for what I call the Ferris Commit Club. That's something that is really important and the next big milestone for the DevEx initiative as a whole. And that's the other side of the coin to sponsorship. So coming back to the original point, I've got lots on, basically, and I get exposed to a lot of different areas that really stretch my understanding, my knowledge of the language, and it helps me grow as a programmer as well. You know, I get lost in the room when a lot of the folks are talking about the formal verification stuff, even though it's like super interesting, but it's incredible to be in there because it gives me insights and it helps me understand the type system better, why the type system is so great. I still do have a lot of fun with Rust as a programming language.
That's awesome. And I kind of asked that because, this has been a bit of a recurring theme on this podcast, but I've had to kind of, you know, admit to the fact that, you know, maybe I should not be someone who contributes to Rust through just pure like code slinging.
I know.
You know, like there's so many just very seasoned Rust programmers who already, you know, give their time to...
Don't do that to yourself. You see, this is what, like, I'm trying to help dissipate.
Yeah, and that's why I wanted to get your take on it.
I feel like, how would I ever be worthy to contribute to the Rust project when you've got Esteban and Nico and all of these incredible people that you see on Twitter, right? But... You see, that also goes in part and parcel with just, you know, having a mechanism to empower yourself, you know, which is partly what I'm talking about with the Ferris Commit Club. What I want to do with that is I want to create, again, an on-ramp, which kind of forms this hybrid of a therapy session for imposter syndrome, a Google Summer of Code type program, and the presentation platform for people to go from zero to their first contribution to Rust. So the therapy session part of it comes in like a group conversation where we talk about ourselves and our, like, why we don't feel worthy or what we can do to kind of get over ourselves a bit when it comes down to making a contribution. The Google Summer of Code component is actually having mentorship to walk you through your first commit, to walk you through your first PR that you want to open on the Rust project or any open source project that you're interested in, you know. And then the kind of presentation part is where you have people who have done this before, who have gone before you, the giants on, you know, that on the shoulders that you're standing on, who can kind of lead you forward and be like, hey, I've been here too, you know, I went through the same sort of feelings of whatever, right, to kind of get to this place. And, you know, hopefully that will be a guiding on-ramp for people to feel confident enough to make a contribution. Of course, that comes to another, I don't want to say problem, but it opens up another challenge on how a new influx of contributors coming into a project are managed, you know, because there's the whole project management component of things, which Mara Boss has talked about. And also, I am so sorry, the name escapes me now, but they are an amazing lead contributor on Bevy. But they've also mentioned project management for open source, almost treating it, you know, like a in production entity, you know, having the same mechanisms and the same people who manage a project, like you would in a commercial project, coming in to open source and doing the same thing, because you don't just want a bunch of new contributors coming in, and you know, you can't, it almost overwhelms you. But yeah, I think that it's, in the long run, it's a net positive having more people empowered to contribute to Rust, you know. So, dude, we're gonna get some PRs open soon. All right, we're gonna get on it. We're gonna get working on it. We're gonna do some peer programming, and we're gonna get some PRs opened one day, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly one approach to it, you know, make it a lot easier and the barrier to entry a lot lower for, you know, making PRs to these open source code bases. I think I've been going at it from a slightly different angle and starting to widen my definition of what a contributor is.
Yes, right. Absolutely.
And then it's very insightful and refreshing, I would say, to talk to someone like yourself who seems very comfortable with, you know, contributing in ways other than, you know, putting in patches and actual code contributions, right? Like, it's very clear that, you know, you found this route through which, you know, you can make this these sorts of contributions that you really care about and want to see in the ecosystem.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you for saying that, because, you know, it's the in-between bits, right? It's the in-between bits, and it's like the glue in between a lot of what we don't see, which really makes everything kind of work. And, you know, I'm grateful to be able to contribute in any way. You know, I think it's something that's really important, and I'm very big on being on the ground and being in the mud with things. Because it is self-serving as well, because I've mentioned it before when I was telling, you know, giving my background, that it helps the community, but it also empowers me, you know, my own confidence issues, my own insecurities. I work through them, through these contributions, but there's also the benefit to the community in and of itself as well. You know, so I'm very grateful, very humble to, you know, be able to contribute in any way. And I'm also very grateful for the growth that it's given me on a personal level as well.
Yeah. I'm just starting to think now, you know, where can I take that and what can we talk about next? It, I don't know. Like that, I think, I mean, we definitely covered all the main points I wanted to hit. I don't know. Do you think there's anything in the story that we haven't touched on think is important to highlight?
We've got, there's lots to come in the future, hopefully. I really do believe that things with open source maintenance, contribution, and funding have to evolve for things to continue to thrive, for there to be more Rusts in the future. Because Rust, you know, if you look at a lot of different programming language communities and, you know, new programming languages that have emerged, it really does stand out alone in the way it's been able to do community, in the way it's been able to push the needle forward, even in a lot of different conversations. It's not perfect by any means, but it really does stand out as an outlier with all of the things that the community have been able to do. So I really do believe that we need to continue the dialogue around how free open source does money, the interactions with money and commercial entities, and the ways of benefiting people who do the slog work, who do the ugly stuff on the ground, the stuff that is very unsung, you know, the unsung heroes who really make things work. And it benefits commercial entities in the long run, and even in the short run, because there's kudos there for actually being someone who's providing sustenance to an open source community through sponsorships and things like that. And there is also benefit to their bottom line. If you're using Rust for your stack, in your stack, and you're relying on crates that need to be maintained, yes, of course, you can just hire the maintainer, but it's also great if the maintainer has the option to continue doing what they know is best for the project in and of themselves, and is they're maintained, they're looked after, you know. It helps your infrastructure continue to be viable, and it helps everybody grow. So I really want to get across the message, just in wrapping up, that we need to, all of us, everybody who is a stakeholder in free open source software and open source in general, we need to get together to really look at tackling how we do money. There's a lot of great articles about, you know, open source is broken, and a bunch of other articles around, you know, this topic in particular. But this is something that we're really trying to push forward and drive forward. So that's pretty much my hill. And that's the drum that I'm going to keep beating on. Again, I just want to say a big thank you for having me on here. And it's been amazing speaking with you. Please check out the DevX Initiative on Twitter, mostly. If you DM the DevX Initiative, it will pretty much come to me. At DevX Initiative. Also, if you're ever in London, it would be great to have take you down for a drink in a pub after a boot up. So yeah, the Rust London, we do our meetups monthly. So if you're ever in town, Sean, if you're ever in London, it would be great to take you out to a pub in London and have a drink.
That would be awesome. I've never been yet. It's been on the travel bucket list for a while.
Yeah, but, you'll love it. You'll love it. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, man, this was awesome, Ernest. It's great to just hear you wax about, you know, these topics.
Thank you. Thank you. I hope I didn't bang on too much.
No, I really enjoyed it. And I hope the listeners do too. I think I tend to get a lot of folks on here who are very deep in the technical stuff. And you know, that's obviously great. But this was refreshing. And I really appreciated it.
Thank you. Thank you. That's great to hear.
Yeah. So, thanks everyone for listening. Hope you enjoyed the conversation with Ernest. If you'd like to send us an email, you can do that at buildingwithrust@gmail.com. We're also in the Rustation Station Discord if you want to drop on by there and give any sort of feedback or thoughts or whatever. We'd really appreciate it. But yeah, thanks everyone for listening, and we'll catch you in the next one. Thanks.